What I'm wondering is kind of that playful, competitive, chaotic environment. Is that something that you implemented in all of your stints as a college coach? I know you were at maybe four different universities over your career. Is this something that you developed over that period of time, or were you always using that philosophy to bring out the best in your players?
When I first started coaching, I was like 22, 23, and I was offered a job at UC Santa Barbara where I had played at. And I'd been the captain and of our team then. And I also, I'm coaching guys that I'm just a few years younger than me. And I realized, and at first, you feel like to be a good coach, you have to drill, drill, drill. But then I realized that you come out day in and day out and being on the team, I was always hoping, was the coach going to let us play?
Welcome to Courtside Sessions, the show designed for junior tennis players, parents, and coaches to help them maximize their game. I'm Diadem Kev, and today we're going to talk to a Hall of Fame coach who has a notebook full of tips and tricks that is older than I am, a coach who's worked with names like Sampras and Courier, and one that you're going to hear during the show that I'm sure you'll be familiar with. I'm excited to have Boise State tennis legend, Coach Greg Patton, the General, take some time out of his Idaho mountain vacation to speak with us today.
We're here with Greg Patton. How are you doing today, Coach Patton?
Great. I'm loving it. Loving being with you guys. This is going to be fun.
Yeah, I'm especially excited because I had a chance to check out some of the other videos of you that are floating around on the internet. And it seems like you have a very interesting philosophy. I saw a notebook that was about this thick that had some handwritten notes in there. So it seems like you've taken that 42-year career and really made the most of it.
It was a fountain of youth. It's the fountain of youth. Tennis and being involved with young people is the greatest thing in the world. I'm still waiting to grow up, and I'm in a perpetual state of I don't want to say immaturity, just a childlike. And that basically is because the secret to vitality and being vibrant is that childlike sense of play. And I really believe that some of the greatest athletes in any and all sports, and especially in tennis, have this marvelous sense of childlike sense of play, which is that joy and the abundance when they're playing a game. And I think that is the key to developing champions. And it's not this, I think hard work definitely is kind of the base of it, but really it's more than that. And it's beyond that. It's a question of playing with joy, not playing or working hard. Is once you embrace something and you embrace the joy of it, then it's really easy to become a champion. And if you look at, I'm reading a book right now. I read a lot of books about tennis. I'm reading a book called Master by Cleary about Roger Federer. And that's the one, this childlike sense of awe and wonder that Roger had in his game. There's no doubt the same thing. That's what Rafa brings to the game, is this excitement, this thrill, in welcoming all this, the sense of play. And you know what happens in play is there's chaos, okay? And when I train players, I try to create a sense of chaos because you are never more alive and you're never more aware when there's chaos, when you don't know what the end result's going to be. Sometimes I think that when we train too much in patterns and drills. And what happens is you're a good driller, but once you start playing the game, all of a sudden different things enter in. A ball off the net or a slice shot or, these types. And that's where a champion becomes great, because he loves the fact that there's these different things that are being created and that he can respond to. It's like a dance. And the dance is not choreographed. It's more of a free-spirited dance. And I believe that immensely For example, right now, you know, Chris Eubanks is all of a sudden he's starting to blossom and really illuminate the sky. And what he does that with several things is his joy for the game. And I was, gosh, it's a honored that he played on our national collegiate team 2016. So I was able to travel with Chris and to see that. And you knew that he had not the makings of a champion, but that he was a champion. Because just his attitude and, you know, if you have gratitude in your attitude, you're going to get altitude. And there was that thankfulness. It's almost like you want your opponent to play better. And if you get this attitude that you want your opponent to play better, to bring out the best in you, that there's no way that you're not going to be able to, you're just going to get better. It's like being a surfer. I grew up in California. I grew up in Santa Barbara. And one of the first sport I ever learned was how to surf because we lived a block away from the beach. We had to climb out on this cliff and get in the water. And, you know, you always wanted a bigger wave. You wanted a more exciting wave. It's not like we wanted a real easy wave that I could stand up on. It's the same thing. No, I'm in the mountains of Idaho right now. And when you go skiing, you don't want a bunny hill. You know, you always want a little bit more of an exciting, even kind of dangerous slope to ski down. So my whole goal is to be able to, first of all, touch the athlete so that they want, you know, you always want to play a better player, don't you? Doesn't everybody want to go out and practice with a better player? And that's the first step in the direction of learning to love the joy of this game. And once you learn to love, truly love it and embrace it, there's, like I said, there's no way you're not going to be able to get better. You will get better. And then also that if you don't evaluate your success on wins and losses, but you basically evaluate yourself and then you embrace the fact that you are getting better, you know, so that's another component of this whole journey. And I love being on that journey. I do know that, like working with young people, and, you know, most of my career has been working with collegiate players. And part of my career was traveling with the best juniors from the U.S. back in the, gosh, it was in the, before the 80s, was it? Yikes. Yeah, I worked with the Junior Davis Cup team when Sampras was a junior and Courier was a junior and Agassi was a junior. You know, and then my second gig with the national team was in 98 to 2002. So that's with Roddick and Sam Querrey and those guys. But I found that they always wanted the challenge. You know, the challenge was a better player. It wasn't like in a better hit. And they always were seeking out guys to play with that were better, but also players that they could a dance partner that they could dance with, that they could have more fun. So one of the things that I always feel like talking to young people is the number one ingredient. The first thing that if you want to be good, and if you love this game, you love the rhythm of it, the cadence and the beat, is you have to make friends. Make friends. Genuine friends. Even on that, I remember this, watching this, I think it was on HBO, about Marty Fish and his relationship with Andy Roddick. And they needed each other to lift each other. So that's one thing, that if you're a tennis player, you need a community of tennis players. You need to want not only for yourself to get better, but more importantly, you want your teammates, your playmates, the people that you play with, you want them to improve. So if you almost go out with the attitude that I'm going to make my friend and my comrade in this game of tennis, and if your goal is I got to make him better, which means I got to play better, doesn't it? And I cannot, and I, my emotions are that, you know, hey, if he's hitting a great shot, great for you, because in the long run, it is going to illuminate. It's that radiance is going to hit you. Now, that's the key of a good coach, is to get them, to get your players to understand that. You know, I mean, when Pete Sampras was coming up, I remember that, is we had a lot of great players at the junior Davis Cup. And Pete is an introvert. Yeah, he is not an extrovert. He's like that type of guy in the back of the room. He's shy. He's kind of, but boy, when he got on the tennis court, he would just blossom. And it was creating a network of a lot of guys. And Courier was part of that, as I said, you know, and then the rivalry between Pete and Andre started a little bit right at the end of their junior career. And it was finding those guys that could push each other. You know, it's like climbing a mountain. If your partner, you're climbing, that's steep and he's going, let's go for it. Let's go for it. We can do this. You've got to go along. You cannot let fear or doubt get in your head, in your way. So that's the reason I loved when I worked with the USTA for off. I mean, I'm still doing it, is creating community, a community of players and bringing them together. You know, and making a team. And that's really important because tennis, if it's in a team sport, an arena, you're going to blossom. You're going to blossom in that type of arena. And it happens time in and time out. That's the reason I think the academies became so important that they, you know, and Nick was the first one, is he just brought a bunch, Nick Bollettieri brought a bunch of great players together, you know, to Fort Lauderdale, or I'm trying to remember where it was, Bradenton. And yeah. I remember coaching the junior national team and these guys were going back and forth from there. And that was great because ultimately it really wasn't in the coaching or the great facilities. It was just the fact that it was like a camping trip and everybody was there, you know, you're all there and you're sharing your ideas and you're looking at each other and you're learning without even knowing it. It was unconscious, subliminal education, you know, and it was not as much as what you could tell a player or organize. It was just putting the lit together and letting that creativity and all that gamemanship flow. So the one thing that I've even felt is this, I've been a big proponent always of the games-based philosophy of coaching, which is, create games, create competition. And that is how you're going. And with competition, there's chaos, right? You never know what's going to happen. Just play different games with different rules and how the player can adapt to the different rules when they're playing. For example, you know, we play, you know, like pass the racket where you have to give you what you're playing with one racket and you have four guys on your side and you're kind of playing around the block where you're trying, you know, hitting a ball and it forced you, the things that you would learn was when you're playing a game, like around the block, even passing the racket, there's chaos. And it's the ability that when there's chaos has happening and I'm passing a racket to my partner to play a singles play, it almost helps me with my position in terms of moving back, in terms of hitting a ball, reacting to where the ball's going to go. You know, and I can name 1,000 different games that we would do that, which would create the problem solving and is almost becomes innate. There's almost not overthinking and you're not a robot being, you know, but what you're doing is you're as a human adapting to the things and the shots that you've been given. And then you go on to react in a very positive way. So I get excited about this. You can see I sometimes go from one thing to another, but it all kind of leads into that. And I think if you coach with passion, purpose, and love, that you can really, basically what we should be is like Valentine. Is how the players fall in love with the game and fall in love with this lifelong game. And then once you do that, you've been successful as a coach. So I think that's the first thing is you are kind of like, it's like St. Valentine's Day. You're the one that brings out the box of candies in the heart shape and you give it to the player and say, okay, let's have you fall in love with this game. Because what always is when you leave the court, you always want to have that feeling, no matter if you win or lose, that you want to come back and you want to do that dance again.
I love
it. So
that.
I kind of threw a lot of stuff at you in the intro. I don't, you know, there's no rhyme, or there is a rhyme and reason to it.
No, that's awesome. I really enjoy talking to coaches that have a well thought out philosophy and were able to implement it with success over such a long period like you have been able to. What I'm wondering is kind of that playful, competitive, chaotic environment. Is that something that you implemented in all of your stints as a college coach? I know you were at maybe four different universities over your career. Is this something that you developed over that period of time, or were you always using that philosophy to bring out the best in your players?
I think what came down when I first started coaching, I was like 22, 23, and I was offered a job at UC Santa Barbara where I had played at, and I'd been the captain and you know, of our team then. And I also, I'm coaching guys that I'm just a few years younger than me. And I realized, and at first, you know, you feel like to be a good coach, you have to drill, drill, drill. But then I realized that you come out day in and day out and being on the team, you know, I was always hoping, was the coach going to let us play? You know, are we just going to play? You know, and I realized that when you set up a lot of games and a games-based program, is that it became so much more fun, and I wanted to be out there because I was on the court so much. And I felt like it was conducive to want the player to have them, as I said, fall in love with the game. And it basically was a sense of the competition is to compete all the time. And to adapt the games to the skills that you wanted them to learn. For example, to learn how to volley. Well, there's a lot of dinkum. You know, we played a lot of dinkum, and then mini me, where you might be, you know, tapping the ball to yourself, and then you hit it, but you can't hit it for a winner, but you start learning the angles. And there's, you know, the games go on and on in terms of, you know, how I've always loved, you know, around the block, which is, you know, you can put eight people on the side, four on the side, and they're alternating, you know, and then creating different obstacles in terms of, like, you have to use one racket or something. I also believed that the beauty of the game, and I'm going to go somewhere about the rhythm of the game, which is incredibly important, is they say, and years ago, I read this book called Healthy Brain, Happy Life. And it was talking about the fact that it stimulates the hippocampus. Hippocampus is, it controls our frontal lobe and the four lobes in there. And that is the people that are creative and that are, that can absorb, are very good at learning, is they've activated this frontal lobe, the hippocampus. And it, in fact, it impacts tennis and sports dramatically. Like, Stephen Curry has this ability to where he incites it, ignites that flame in here in this brain, where that he trusts his skills, but everything slows down. Stan, is when you're playing your best, it seems like everything's slowing down. There's a calming down. There's not a rush. There's not a sense of panic or hurry, but everything slows down. And so what's happened is you've turned on the hippocampus. Now, how do you do that? You do that with basically there's four components to that. It's music, which when I talk about music, music's really important. So we used to play with music all the time, and I still do, as I think it's really important. And I mean, I can tell you, for example, when Andy, I was working with Andy Roddick one time, he's wearing an ear. In those days, it was the thing you would put in the ear, and then you'd have a wire go to your, you know, your pants, your pocket, or your, you know, your shorts. And at first, a lot of people thought, well, that's disrespectful to the coach and the game. But he had music that he was listening to. I used to always have practice with the, you know, the big music box, turn it on. Now, you know, at Irvine, I had a music box. When I went to Boise State, I developed speakers into the. And I think so there'd be the cadence, the rhythm, the beat of the song, and putting it to the beat, the cadence, the rhythm of hitting a tennis ball. because tennis is probably one of the most rhythmic games in the world. So that ignites it. So you get music. Music will ignite. And that's the reason music is a commonality between every society in the world. Okay, the next one is movement. That's like the dance. So we have music, and lots of times music will get people moving. Moving ignites the hippocampus. It ignites. We're talking the fact that you don't have to, I got to think hard. I've got to think really hard, and I got to memorize this. No, you be. You go along like you're on a boat going down a river, and you're floating down the river. You flow with it. And if the tempo of the river gets bigger, you're floating faster, right? Well, the game can start moving. But if you have a beat and a rhythm that's going on with the game and you're into it, all of a sudden you're going to play better. But that also, your awareness, there's a sharpness. Everything is illuminated in terms of your vision, and your brain's not thinking. It's just adapting. So the next thing is music, movement, touch, and language. Now, touch is, in a lot of ways, it might be just, giving the fist, or it's looking to your team. And also language is positive language. So it cannot be negative language. Negative language obviously will stifle the hippocampus. It'll stifle your ability. It'll stifle your emotions. It'll make it negative. So the thing is, it's always got to be a come on, or it's got, let's go, or, those types. And the language is also an internal language, and it's the way that you think, like this excitement. Now, this goes on one step further, is that, and so think of those four commonalities that will instigate, will turn on the hippocampus, and clarity and memory, which is what the hippocampus does. Our memories is related to this. And you do this in a match, then it comes to the thing that I think is really important. We as human beings sometimes get too big for our own selves, in the sense that we think we go out and we go, I got to win this match. I got to win this match. And that also goes into, and the thoughts are always going, okay, so this match, I got to win this set. All right. And so what I'm saying is, you don't want to go into a match thinking you got to win the match. You don't go into the match thinking I've got to win the set. You don't go into a game, in the middle of the match, you go, I got to win this game. I got to win this game. I'm down 3-4. We're on serve in the third set. I got to win this, or he's going to serve. Once you start thinking that way, that's thought process, it inhibits you. It impedes you. It destroys you. It's a negative thing. So what you got to do is, it's not even go to, I need to win this point. It's what you do is you collect yourself, and you think, and the only process is, I am fully present, fully focused, and fully diligent to just winning the ball, that one ball. It's easy to do at the start if you get to the serve and you're prepared and you see what your target you want it to be. And it's not even like I'm going to hit an ace, like this, I'm going to go for this target. I'm going to relax. I relax the body. Then I hit the serve. Okay. I'm fully focused and I see it in my mind's eye. And if I'm serving, all I'm thinking is making sure I see the ball come out of the hands. And I have an advantage in a sense, because I know where the ball is going to go because of the service box, right? So I'm waiting to see where the ball is going to bounce, to be really focused where the ball is going to be. And my only duty and responsibility is to hit the ball back in the court. And I would have a target where I would want to hit the ball. It'd be down the middle. Or would it be down the line, if it might be on a second serve, or would it be generally the cross court shot, right? Now, once I hit that return, all of a sudden it's over, and my next shot is, the only thing I need to do is win the next ball, is the reply from my opponent. So this all goes back into practice and playing games like that, and creating an environment, you know, creating an environment where you're playing this game, you got to be fully focused and present. I love games that are chaotic. For example, triples, for example, and we would do this every day, you know, three zone, you know, where you have two guys defending against, you know, a line of opponent, your teammates. And I loved it. The more players you can put on the court, the more fun it is, but the more they get out of it, right? So, and, you know, here's college guys. And I was doing this play when I coached world team tennis. I coached world team tennis. I had Andy Roddick on my team. Gosh, I had Sam Querrey on my team. I've had, you know, Zena Garrison on my team, Katrina Adams on my team. You know, we played Borg, Connors, you know, and as the years went on, the, you know, all these players, and it was when team tennis was really big. And so our practices were always, we had this opportunity to play a bunch of crazy games all the time. When I take my team to France, I had teams of three men and three women to play in the world championships in France. And I've done that for 12, 14 years. And the first thing we do when we get off the flight, I don't want them to go to bed. I want them to get in, adjusted to the time frame of, you know, zone in France. So we go to the courts, and the first thing we do would be triples, you know, three people on a side. And we'd use the serve and the return. And then you're having this, and, you know, and only one person can be in the two service boxes and the two other people on the baseline. Not only was it fun, but they were competing, and they have to be fully present. They have to be fully focused, you know. And so what you're doing is you're not thinking about how you're playing. What you're doing is you're just reveling in the joy, and you know how to play, and you let the body, you give the responsibility over to the body because you've done this as you've grown up. So for a lot of the players that are listening to this are probably tournament players. And that's the type of thing is you get out and you compete, and you have the noise, the music, and you have the cadence and the beat. I also, ever since I was a young coach, and when I was, like, as I said, I was 23, you know, my team used to play dingles every day, and dingles with a serve and return. And you know what that is? Just two playing cross court. You're playing cross court. Once there's a miss, then the court opens up, and then you play doubles, and you're keeping score. And I think keeping score is always really important because it keeps you accountable for what you're doing. I think sometimes you get so there is a purpose and a reason for everything, and the whole reason is you want to have energy. All right. Energy is really important. Nothing great is ever achieved without energy. Nothing. The great leaders, the great musicians, the great, you know, architects, the great writers, the great musicians have energy. But energy isn't something that you can just open the thing. You just don't bring it out. The tools to getting energy. So this is for tennis players. Now, the tools for energy, you have to have a purpose. Purpose ignites energy, okay? And it ignites passion. So purpose will give you the passion to go out day in and day out and to be in love with the game, to truly love it, no matter, even when you have a girlfriend or in a relationship, there might be some days are tough, but there's passion there, right? So you go back and to make it better, to make your friendships better. So you have purpose ignites passion, and passion incites miraculous behavior. Think about this, or magical behavior. And magical behavior is when all of a sudden your skills get better and you start getting that ball you didn't think you were going to get. And it's almost like you want the ball to go cross court in the corner. And just that the magic is the fact that you hit this miraculous behavior, or magical behavior. You hit that cross court shot, but you had the purpose and the love and the idea that you're going to dedicate yourself to it. You are going to work for it. You're going to put time into it. And when you do that, then it develops a passion, and the passion and that love for it means you want to go out every day, and you can't wait to go hit, and you can't wait to turn on maybe the music. And as you're hitting and playing, and you get to be with your friends, and that creates that, as I said, this magical behavior that you're getting it, you're getting better. Okay. And you're starting to get wins over people that you didn't have wins over. And then that results into miraculous events. Okay, that's when the miracles happen. Now, some people don't believe in miracles. I believe they happen every day. And so there is that step. I hope I'm being pretty clear with this, because I talk to my players all the time. Purpose. Come with me with purpose. What's your purpose today? So when you came out with this podcast today, you had a purpose. Okay. And the purpose is to make this best podcast you could be with a person like me, who you just really don't know, but you know how to ask the right question, right? And so what happens is you've ignited a passion. You wanted to see what my answers would be. I jumped right into it, okay, because I love this. Now, energy, I love this. Energy creates synergy, okay, even between you and I talking, all right? And that synergy is a working together with passion, caring, really care, because the only people that get anything out of life care about their lives, care about other people's lives, care about the beauty of this journey that we're on. And when you have that, this energy creates winergy. Energy, and you and I with our synergy creates winergy.
I like that. I never heard winergy before. That's a good
there
one.
You are. I thought of that years ago, and I thought one time I was on the court, and I think I was saying, "Gosh dang it!" I go, "Man, we've got the energy, don't you? We have energy. We're going to get sick each other." What happens is winergy. Oh my God, where did that come from? So it's always one thing, and I write all that stuff down on my, I have this book. I tell you, everywhere I go, if you want to, everybody get, I call this the Bible. All the players ever played for me in the last 40 years, I've had this thing. I write down all my thoughts. And so if you look at it, there's almost no rhyme to the reason. So I just, as you can see, any page, I just have stuff there that I want me to read and to keep me on track. Because my goal in life, my path in life, has always been try to be a mentor to get people to be the very best they can be as a tennis player and as a person, you know? And when you do that, then you have relationships that last forever, you know? And as a player, and that's one thing, I was talking to a player of mine just yesterday, and we were talking, and he's in New York City. Washington, D.C. And he's working in, in the government. He's got his PhD now, and he was a player for me at Boise State, and it was joyful to have those relations and to have the relationship, like, you know, with Courier and Sampras and Roddick and, you know, all of the Bryan brothers, all these guys I've been on the court with. And, you know, it's just been, it's touched and illuminated my life to be able to see that and to see and to learn from them. See, this is one thing too, when coaches listening, is we not only learn from each other, but we learn from our players. You know, you learn that. You learn something. You've learned things about them. For example, with Roddick. Roddick, in some ways, his game was big and his serve was big. And, you know, everybody wanted to have that beautiful service motion where he had something. I mean, he had something that was special. And then you realize it was the fact that I felt like with Roddick, the one thing I learned is we don't play with small muscles. You know what I mean? Sometimes coaches are too intent, like, you know, people are thinking, well, what's your swing path with your arm and this and that. The great players play with big muscles, which is the core. You know, it's they play with their body. Okay. And they play also, you know, your eyes see the ball. Okay. Very important. The vision, you see the ball. So I see it. And you have the feet move to it, right? So your feet, your eyes see it, the feet move, and the hands find. Right. So that's basically it. You see that. But once you, all those three things are basically for this whole use of the body. I see feet find, move, hands find the ball. But what happens when the hands find, you're not hitting the ball at the hand. You're hitting the ball with the whole kit and caboodle, which is the body, the whole body. And it's all connected. And so that's the beauty of the game of tennis. Now, when you play chess, it's your mind. It's a very mental, you know, game, which is great. But in tennis, the mind's playing as well as the body's playing. And it's like, you trust this vehicle, you know, but you have to train the vehicle how to move. You have to train the vehicle to have the vehicle who's a race car, and it's got the right engines, got the right oil, and has got the right fuel. Okay, to be able to move and play on this, because it's a movement in different direction, in every direction that's conceivable, almost, you know, up, back, down, low, I mean, low, high, it's all these different things.
Oh, 100%.
So yeah, synergy is big.
Yeah, I love that concept. I think that in sports and life, any team environment that you're working in, synergy is really paramount to bringing out the best that you and your team can be. So I love to hear that's something important for you and all the success you've had with the teams and groups you've coached. Another important thing with having a successful career as a college coach is recruiting. I'd love to hear a little bit about your philosophy in recruiting players, maybe any tips that junior players can look to help put them in a better position to get recruited. Anything like that. I also believe you may have been one of the early adopters in going to international markets to bring players to your program. I'd love to hear a little bit about that too, if you could.
Recruiting is it's selling yourself and selling your program, but it's also finding good guys, really good. Okay, so I say guys, use this also with females. I've been most of my life, I've coached primarily males. When I worked with the national collegiate team, I do travel with the women and the men. So that has been good. But recruiting is the one thing I think a lot of players got to realize is that good people make good teams, right? And there's no doubt then when you can surround a player, even someone who's an introvert like Pete, you know, you surround them with a lot of guys during the course of the summers when he's a junior, and he created a team that helped him flourish, you know, that he was involved with people with the same goal and they cared about each other. And so that was important. I feel like for me, one of the most important things is what the player was like and what his dreams and goals were like, and if it would embrace, would fit into our philosophy and in terms of our goals and our culture. So it's a question of almost really getting, but the relationship with a college coach and with the players going in with a college coach is you're getting a mentor and you're getting a guide. Okay. And so this is really important because this person's going to impact your life as a player. So I'm talking to the young people right now. The person you go with as a coach are your best interest and needs as a student and as an athlete at the paramount of where the program, and can you, and does the players in the program, do they embrace their philosophy? So it's getting to know the players to understand, because what truly is, you can go to the most beautiful school in the world on the beaches of the Caribbean, but if there's no connection with the people you're there with, it doesn't matter how beautiful the place or how great the facilities are. Will you experience, you know, can you maximize your potential as a player? So I think the team concept, and this is one thing that I've always felt, the team concept, building a family, that when you came and played for me, you're joining a family of a brotherhood of players. And so these are people that are going to share your values and you'll be working for the same common goal, is to be successful representing your school. So I know that some coaches, they want the best possible player. And other coaches go, they want the best possible people. And if you can be even a player that is, because there's no way you're not going to improve in an environment that is very positive and nurturing, but also challenging. So you want to really kind of find that culture and that environment where you can thrive and flourish. Now, I always felt, to be honest with you, I didn't embrace the foreign element as much as other coaches did and programs did. When I was at UC Irvine, my team was primarily Americans. And when I went up to Boise State, I still wanted a strong American presence, but I also had at Boise State, we did start bringing players in. And it's funny, once you bring a player in from another country, then all of a sudden he brings another friend of his in. But that was really what I thought was really important, is it added to the culture of our own program. I had some British players that were amazing, and they were really, they loved. The one thing that we offered was a team concept that they weren't used to, because, you know, it was all about them when they were training, and there's really, they don't really have much team tennis. And they came into this and it was all about the team. And we structured the, you know, having games all the time where they were playing with three or four guys on a court, and they're playing, you know, practice matches where I would put one team, the other team would, you know, would get kind of prizes or, you know, rewards. And so they were getting to the point where they were sharing in the success of each other. And the British guys that I had loved it, you know, and they embraced our culture when I was at Boise State emphatically. You know, they really, really enjoyed it. So it was always kind of a thing, but I always felt like with Americans, the thing is, Americans, that's the reason I loved it, our program, they embraced the idea of, like, you know, you go to Boise State and we had a great football team and we became big friends with the basketball team. And, you know, that was part of we had our cred, you know, and the hat and the shirts that said Boise State, and they were into it. And the Americans are into it even more than, but once the internet guys came in, they would tend to embrace it. And I found, like, you know, like, let's say I almost was able to get Cam Norrie to come to Boise State. And I thought we had a good shot. And then he went to TCU and had just a tremendous career there. And he had a bunch of Americans surround him. Roditi had a good way of recruiting. And he played with a guy named Trevor Johnson. And they were, you know, Trevor was this black guy from Las Vegas who, you know, in Vegas, and the bright lights of Vegas. And Trevor was another guy that I was recruiting really hard and loved the guy because his charisma and his team, you know, it was like he liked to always play basketball with guys and be on the team and, you know, get together. And it was something Cam really embraced, you know, and I felt the British kids always embrace the team concept better. That's the reason you see so many good Brits on this pro circuit now that are doubles players, you know, and they found a living doing a tennis by being great doubles players. And so that's, I think, another thing that helped with our programs. I've had two teams get to the finals, the semis or the finals, the NCAAs. Two teams got to the finals, the NCAAs in doubles. That I had it, you know, but they were always Americans. The Americans embrace that. I had teams that got to the semis there, and one was a guy, Ernesto Diaz, who originally is from Chile, but he grew up in California, played with a guy named Alvin Poloni, who was from Missouri on our team. And then I had another guy named, got to the finals, Trevor Cronenman, who's the executive director now of the Southern California Tennis Association. And his partner was Michael Briggs, and they played doubles together, and they were tied. And once they went on the circuit together, two teammates from the same school, UC Irvine, were number three in the world on the ATP. So it's really cool. But my whole priority with recruiting was the quality of the kid, you know, and how he would embrace the team concept. And really would understand the fact that the best way to get better is through others. You know, is this joint, that's the reason I was so big in the USTA when I worked for the USTA, was always develop a team. Don't just focus on the one guy that maybe at the time is the top ranked player in the country or in the world, but use him to grow, you know, in an environment. For example, we had Stevie Johnson on a team with Sam Querrey in the juniors. And these were just two guys, and they were, you know, fighting to be, you know, to get into the top 10 in the U.S. junior rankings, and look at where they came to. Is, and to, you know, basically to find, if someone wants to join the family, it's more than a team, is to join a family where they all have common goals, common dreams, and this commitment to not only themselves, to each other, to make each other better. And that's really important. The Swedes did it, you know, and the Swedes, a long time ago, when the Swedes were really dominating tennis, they were all team. They're all involved in a team. The Swedes all together, and they go watch each other and they support each other. And that's the thing I think that the U.S. needs to do and emphasize, is to keep making sure that our Americans are supporting each other. And they're doing it now. You can see it. You can see how many. But a lot of them are college players. Mackie McDonald, Marcus Giron, Chris Eubanks, Austin Krajicek. All those guys were Americans who played college tennis and now are, you know, at the top. So Austin Krajicek's number one in the world in the ATP doubles right now. And you're looking, Chris, his rankings jumped way up there. And look at Shelton, Ben. Ben's doing unbelievable stuff. And his dad, by the way, played world team tennis for him. And his dad, I worked with him on the Junior Davis Cup team when his dad was there. And his dad, and then he played for me in world team tennis. So there's this thread of a community. And there's this, and then it binds you. That you're bound to it. You're bound by the friendships. You're bound by that. You need others. And that's the one thing. I think every kid, everybody in the juniors, I think the biggest mistake is to take them out of a community where they're day in and day out playing with their friends and competing with them, but also rejoicing in their victories. It's almost like the culture should be, my job is to make you as good as I can possibly be. And play my best, play with a positive attitude, have a lifestyle that is contingent upon doing the right things, making the right decision, you know, making the right decisions in your lifestyle and the types of decisions in terms of your decisions that you make in life with hanging out with the right people. Because if you do that, there is absolutely no doubt that you're going to maximize the best you can be in yourself as a player. You're going to just explode in terms of being greatness. Greatness is you're not going to, you know, doing, making the right decisions, you're going to be great.
I love that. And, outside of coaching, where you've obviously had so much success, something that you've done that might be even more of an impactful task is obviously raising your two kids, Chelsea and Garrett. And they both went on to have a pretty successful tennis career at the college level. And I believe Garrett's coaching college tennis now. For all the parents that are listening, do you have any advice on how they can help their kids get to the level of tennis that they aspire to play at?
Yeah, you know, I think the one thing that's really important. So, and I did this with my own, and I saw like coaches like Dick Leach with his, you know, sons Johnny and Ricky that both played on the circuit. Is your main role as a parent is to love them, you know, and I found, because I was working with junior players when I was like 21, 22, and I didn't have my kids until my daughter was, I was 38 and 40 when I had my kids. So I had been around parents a long time and realized that my job was to love them and was to encourage them and was to make this fun and thrilling and make sure it was the best experience of their life. When they were young, I played a lot of games with them. So when I hit balls to them, we'd play, you know, crazy ass games. I put my son on a court and I would hit balls at him and he'd have to hit volleys sitting down when he was like 10 years old. He thought it was the funniest thing in the world. Or I'd play games that if he missed a shot, he would have to put his hand behind his back if he missed another shot. And so that helped. And that's the reason he learned how to hit a one-handed backhand. And then if he missed another shot, he'd have to stand on one leg and I'd feed him a ball. So it was just silly games and played a lot of music. I feel my best thing that I probably did is I had coaches around me who were really good and I could talk to them about Garrett's game and Chelsea's game, but they were really involved in the coaching. And if I had any thoughts, I would tell them and I would let them take it for whatever they thought, rhyme or reason. So I really wanted to be, and I really, really want who's ever listening to this as a parent, just to hear me. I really wanted to be the best father I could possibly be, and being the best tennis coach to my two kids wasn't that important to me. And the reason I say this is because two, I saw a lot of parents ruin their relationships with their kids. And then the kids basically, I lost one player, was a great player on my team, just because his dad was so involved and just made it so. And, you know, once they go to college, they're ready to be adults and move on. And I think what you need is you need your parents to be supportive and then to be the greatest support system for them when they're in college and beyond. And they're the cheerleaders then, just cheerleaders. And even when you're young, they're cheers. All you do is you take them to the playground and you let them play. So the tennis court's the playground and you let them play. And then when they start playing tournaments, as you just are there to love them. I would do something at tournaments with Garrett and Chelsea. After they played, they had to make friends. And at win or lose, we had a tradition that Garrett or Chelsea would ask their friends if they wanted to go to a movie that night. And we'd take them to a movie or take them to Chuck E. Cheese or go bowling. I had one story when Garrett was playing in the National 14s in Texas. He played a guy and he won his first round. So we went to see a movie. And what the movie wanted to see was The Black Knight. Remember that? It's about Batman, The Dark Knight? Mm-hmm. And we really loved it and he loved it. So the next day he's playing and then he loses and he asks the guy, which is really funny because kids, you go up to him and you go, hey, you want to go to a movie or you want to go out to dinner with us? You want to join us? And these are guys, like guys, it's a national tournament. So he didn't know anybody. So the guys, people were like, what are they asking us this for? Sometimes they'd do it. Most half and half people would do something with us and sometimes they wouldn't. But I remember the second night, the guy said, yeah, let's go. The guy had just beat Garrett. And so, yeah, I'll go with you. And we went. And then the third night, Garrett went, he's in the back jaw and he wins and asks the guy to win, if he wants to play. And it was kind of, and I go to Garrett, I go, Garrett, well, what movie? We saw The Dark Knight two nights in a row. Right. So, and he really liked it. So we went the second and we saw it. And the third night, I go, well, where do you want to go to, want to go bowling or you want to go have dinner? And Garrett goes, can we go see The Dark Knight again? And I go, we just saw it two nights in a row. And we went and we saw it a third night. I said the fourth night, we're watching another movie, G. But it's kind of like you romance your kids to the game. I think good coaches romance them to the game. You try to figure out how you can have them fall in love with this game, okay? Where they never hate it, but they love it. But it's to love the game. And you do that through the friends and doing trips. And, when in California, we go down there, we'd always go to the beach because I grew up near the beach and, get a boogie board and take them out. And, Garrett and Chelsea grew up in Idaho, but I used to run a camp at UC Santa Barbara during the summers. And that's, I had a family camp for adults and kids. So those kids grew up in Santa Barbara. So in the morning they go to the beach and play at the beach. And in the afternoon they come to our camp in the afternoon. So, but I think the main thing is finding a good coach, parents, find a good coach that really care about the welfare of your kids and make it fun and have great skills. And there's a lot of them, out there that do wonderful, wonderful things. Finding the mentor is great. I think being a parent and trying to be the great coach to him is really difficult to do. And I learned because I saw so many people try it and fail at it. That's the reason I kind of took a back seat to that. And the great thing is my kids still love tennis. And I think that's the proof. You want to see the proof? Garrett was good enough to play out in the circuit for a year after his, and he was one of the top players and he was the best player in the conference. And he's playing. He had national ranking in collegiate tennis and helped my team. Every year, Garrett was a big proponent of us winning our conference. We won our conference every year. We went to the NCAAs and we're in the top 20 every year. And he played at the top of the lineup for me his senior year at the number one. After that, he's played high on our squad. And so I think it was great because it was a sense of family. you know, and the great thing for Garrett, he didn't have any brothers. So the whole idea is we called it the brotherhood. So he had a sense of brothers. And my daughter, same thing. She played at University of Eastern Washington, and she had a great, great, you know, it was a great playing college. It's amazing how successful college players are in life. And any, you know, I was talking, like I said, I was talking to this guy, Greg Wisher. He works for the government. He's working with, you know, in the White House, you know, he's involved in creating policy. I mean, this guy that played tennis for us at Boise State, I mean, guys, he was a CEO of a company, you know, and all these guys are doing it. And so many, another, Neil Grover down at Irvine, Trevor Cronin, these guys are all leaders. They're leaders in what they do, and they're tennis players. And their lives are flourishing. And that's the majority of them, by far the majority. And that's the joyful thing. The best thing about being on a college team is the years later, those friendships last forever. I've went to two alumni things, one for Boise State, then a week later for UC Irvine. See 50 or 60 guys that have played, and the love between them all. It just, and all they do is tell stories about the matches and then about the coaches. And I gotta sit there and bear and hear the coach with all the wild things they say about me. But it's, you know, I sit and take it because it's family. It's you know, that's the whole thing. You create a family with people that have this common love of a game, and that's great. To have a common love because it's the playground aspect and the joy of being a kid making a friend, and then you play on a college team, and those friendships flourish forever because you go through the fire and you fight for each other, and you go to war with each other, and that bonds you unlike anything else. Having your friends in college, the thing that you would bond you if you weren't an athlete is maybe studying together and have study groups. But man, when you're on the court traveling with each other, playing for each other, wearing the swag, having the name of the school there, and playing those matches and fighting for an NCAA championship, you just can't beat it. The friendships are eternal. They will go to your dying day. And that's one of the joys of where I'm at in my life now, is I go to all these reunions. What I found, though, right now is I'm the butt of most of the jokes of the reunions. Where, you know, when you're on the team, man, you're the king, you're the general. You know, you got the troops, you follow me, let's go to war, guys, come on. And then all of a sudden when it's reunions, it's like sitting around and they're laughing about the things I used to say and whatever. And, you know, it's a magical, beautiful thing. And remember, I was talking about those four commonalities, you know, the music. And one thing I want everybody to understand too, when you play music, I'm a big advocate of it. Play, you know, in for example, what's your favorite music you like to listen to?
I would say when I'm playing sports, something more upbeat, or when I'm working out, you know. I listen to some of like the.
What's your favorite music? Or what's your favorite?
I would say like, I've been really into like some of the old school rock stuff recently while I'm exercising, like some of the like AC/DC and stuff like that, yeah. Which is kind of interesting because growing up, I never really listened to that so much, but lately I have been.
What, you know, what they find is the music that most people like is the music they were listening to between the ages of 15 and, you know, 14, 12, 15, till in their late 20s, 25, 26. That's the music they always hang on to, you know. So if you're older and you're listening to music of your parents, I know certain people have listened to the music of their parents. They've heard it a lot, and that's their favorite music. But if they're listening to what their peers are listening to, that's the music they like. I found one that was really a transcended and that was so good for tennis players was reggae. Is, you know, Bob Marley and the Wailers. There's no better music for me, but that's the music I loved when I was 15, 16, 17, 18 years old. And that was the music I went to. And I was able to get a lot of my players, if I could get them listening to that. But I find that now a lot, you know, it's the rap, you know, and this type of music that they really like now is that the music that you have. And when I talk to coaches that are 35 and 40, you know, there, it might be, more of that, maybe the disco or whatever that might be, or some of the music that you were talking about. It's amazing to me that, you know, to find that, because I think coaches need to understand that is when the music you're playing for the kids, it's a lot of, it's the music between the ages that they'll learn between 14 to 25, 26 is the music that they're going to like. And so the music is pretty popular at the time when we're playing, you know, when you're coaching college guys of music, that's pretty much the most popular that they're listening to at that present time. I went off the subject on that, but it always fascinates me to find out what people, what music they like to listen to, because it's usually the music that'll motivate them. Music's a great way of, it's like fishing throughout the hook. It's a great way to get people in tennis, because tennis, no sport, there's no sport that has more beat, more rhythm, and more cadence to it than tennis. You know, hit, bounce, bounce, hit, bounce, hit, bounce, hit, right? Bounce, hit. There's that cadence, which is beautiful. And I really, really enjoy that. I listen to music all the time. I'm always cranking it up when I play. I think it's really, it helps my game and my joy of the game.
No, that's huge. And that's what I was actually going to ask you before we wrapped up, what music you would have going on the playlist there. So pretty cool to hear that it's reggae, it sounds like, is what you'd be bumping on the on the speakers out there. But I'm sure we could stay on and talk for hours and hours about all this stuff. But fortunately, we do have to wrap it up. And I know that you're doing some speaking engagements now, right? And so if anybody wanted to book one of those with you, how could they go about that?
Well, if you want, I've been really fortunate because I get to, I do get to speak, and it's really easy. Just, you can contact me through my email address. It's G Patton. So GPATTON at BoiseState.edu. And I do. I've been speaking to Coach Associations in New Hampshire and spoke at the USPTA. I'll be at New York City at the USTA at Flushing Meadows. I'll be doing a presentation for the USTA there, put on by Dale Evans, who's with the USTA. And yeah, but if you contact me, I love doing it. I speak generally around two or three times a month about all sorts of stuff. As you can probably see, I have a passion and I have a love for tennis and how it impacts our lives in so many different directions. It's the one thing I love talking to even older people is the fact that tennis players live 10 years longer than any other athlete. You want to live a long life? I'm 71 right now, and I'm still kicking butt and taking names. So it's I attribute it to my love of tennis and the love I love to play, and you can play it till the end of your days, and you can play it, and it'll make you live longer and act younger, and it'll keep you dancing and boogieing. So I love to talk about and the tricks I've learned with that. So again, it's gpatton at boisestate.edu. And it's really easy to get a hold of me. And I'm living in Boise, and I still am kind of impacted, and I'm still trying to do a lot of stuff with the Boise State tennis team in terms of promoting it, raising money for them in terms of their goals and dreams. So, but I love doing this. I love speaking with you. It's been a lot of fun. And just remember, just keep hitting the ball. It's going to get, you're going to live longer. You'll be happier. And it's also, it stimulates, like I said, the hippocampus, the movement, movement, language, touch, and music. Every society has that, by the way, music and movement, celebration, by the way. This is one we got to end on. I always say success without celebration is failure. So make sure you're celebrating. Every culture in the world has celebration and love. So love one in each other and keep on having a party. Celebrate. Because every culture in the world has it. And if you're not celebrating, you're not being successful.
I love it, Coach Patton. Thanks so much for taking the time today. It's been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to go celebrate myself, celebrate the rest of the day, and have a great week. So thank you.
Same to you, my brother. Thank you.
I'm so thankful Coach Patton was able to take some time out of his mountain vacation to sit with us. He's a real wealth of knowledge, and I'm sure you're able to pull something out of that conversation. And if you were, please share it with one of your teammates, one of your coaches, one of your friends, one of your family members. Shoot them a DM. We're going to keep pumping out these Courtside Sessions episodes. So if you think you have a compelling story or you know somebody that might be able to help some junior tennis players, parents, and coaches, make sure you guys reach out to us because we'd love to have you on the show. We'd also love to hear your feedback. So if you have a comment, maybe something that you thought was a great part of the show or something that you'd like us to talk about more next time, drop that in the comments below. And as always, make sure you guys are subscribing so you can follow along with all things Courtside Sessions. Of course, I have to do a special shout out to everybody involved on the production team here, with a special thank you to Colin McDowell for all the hours of hard work he put into producing this episode. I'm Diet M. Kev, and make sure you guys stay tuned because we have a lot of Courtside Sessions coming your way.